Let's cover the business and policy landscape, which is particularly rich today. The U.S. government's decision to hold off on blacklisting DeepSeek while simultaneously flagging more than 100 other Chinese technology firms as security risks has 467 points and 516 comments on HN. This is a genuinely complex policy signal that deserves careful reading rather than a simple narrative.
The Reuters reporting suggests that the decision to spare DeepSeek is at least partly pragmatic. DeepSeek's models are open weight. The weights are publicly available, which means blacklisting the company doesn't actually prevent the technology from being used. Once model weights are released publicly, they exist everywhere. Blacklisting DeepSeek primarily prevents U.S. companies from having commercial relationships with the Chinese entity, but it doesn't affect the availability of the underlying AI capability.
That's an important distinction, and it points to a genuine policy challenge with AI that doesn't have a clean parallel in hardware export controls. When the U.S. restricts export of advanced NVIDIA chips to China, that restriction has physical teeth. Chips are physical objects that can be seized at borders. Model weights in a public repository are more like mathematical knowledge, and attempts to restrict mathematical knowledge have a poor historical track record. The NSA tried to classify public key cryptography in the 1970s and largely failed.
The 100-plus firms that were deemed security risks are not named in most coverage I've seen, but the categories reportedly include companies involved in surveillance technology, telecommunications infrastructure, and AI-assisted military systems. The pattern suggests the U.S. is making capability-specific assessments rather than broad sector blacklisting, which is a more defensible analytical framework, even if it's messier to administer.
This is actually a good point to bring in a brief economics and legal note, because the HN thread has some discussion about whether these designations involve antitrust or monopoly considerations on the U.S. side. A listener new to this space might wonder, is there a legal framework that governs how dominant technology positions interact with national security designations? The relevant framework is actually antitrust law, specifically the Sherman Act of 1890, which prohibits monopolization and restraint of trade. In U.S. law, having a large market share is not itself illegal. The test is whether a company acquired or maintained that position through anti-competitive conduct rather than through skill, industry, or foresight. Courts have set the informal threshold for monopoly territory at around 70% market share in a clearly defined market, but that percentage is a proxy, not a bright line. Microsoft, at its peak, held over 90% of the desktop OS market, and that position alone wasn't the problem. The illegal conduct was using that position to foreclose competition in adjacent markets like web browsers. Why this matters for the DeepSeek discussion. When people say the U.S. is trying to protect American AI companies by not blacklisting DeepSeek's open model, there's a background assumption that U.S. companies have a dominant position worth protecting. But if DeepSeek's open weight models are genuinely competitive with U.S. frontier models, the competitive dynamics of the AI industry are more complicated than a simple domestic versus foreign framing.
That's a useful lens, Marcus. The hospital drug repurposing story is lower scoring, just 19 points, but the substance is striking enough that I want to make sure it gets coverage. Researchers at King's College London have documented cases where hospitals and universities are successfully repurposing existing drugs for new indications at costs roughly 90% lower than developing new drugs. The mechanism is that off-patent generics can be tested for new uses through academic clinical trials without the full FDA new drug application process, provided the indication is for a population already eligible for the drug.
The economic logic is compelling. Pharmaceutical R&D has a well-documented problem with late-stage failure. Around 90% of drugs that enter clinical trials fail to get approval, and the cost of those failures is embedded in the prices of the drugs that do succeed. If you're starting from a drug that's already proven safe in humans, you've eliminated a significant portion of that failure risk, and the trial cost drops accordingly. The 90% cost reduction figure is extraordinary if it holds up across a range of indications.
The HN thread is small, but the comments from people in academic medicine are substantive. One recurring point is that the incentive structure still works against this approach. Academic institutions and hospitals don't have the commercial infrastructure to bring repurposed drugs through regulatory approval and to market at scale, and pharmaceutical companies have little commercial interest in running expensive trials for drugs they can't patent. The result is what economists call a market failure. There's clear social value, but no private actor positioned to capture enough of it to justify the investment.
The Adam CAD story, a YCW25 company launching an open-source AI-assisted CAD tool, is worth watching. 187 points and 87 comments, with the HN community doing what it does best, stress-testing whether the AI assistance is genuinely useful or a demo that falls apart on real engineering geometry. The early reaction is cautiously positive, with several mechanical engineers noting that the hard part of AI-assisted CAD isn't generating geometry, it's maintaining parametric constraints and design intent as you iterate, and that's where Adam's approach will be tested.
Australia's SMS sender ID registration requirement from the ACMA, the Australian Communications and Media Authority, has 106 points and 61 comments. Australia is implementing a mandatory registry for SMS alphanumeric sender IDs, which is the technology behind branded SMS messages where you see my bank instead of a phone number. The intent is to prevent phishing and fraud by ensuring only legitimate organizations can send SMS messages under their brand names. The UK has a similar system. The US notably does not, which the thread explores at length.
The US hesitation around SMS sender ID regulation comes down to the First Amendment complexity of requiring registration for communication, which doesn't apply in Australia or the UK in the same way. Several people in the thread make the case that the US's laissez-faire approach to SMS has made it significantly easier for scammers to impersonate banks and government agencies, and that the downstream cost in fraud losses is substantial.
The Madrid Metro construction story from Works in Progress has 157 points and 101 comments. The 2024 piece examines how Madrid built its metro system at dramatically lower per-kilometer costs than comparable systems in New York, London, or Paris. The short answer is a combination of continuous tunneling rather than cut-and-cover excavation, national workforce that specialized and scaled through repetition, and a procurement model that kept contracts simple and changes expensive. The HN thread generalizes this into a broader conversation about why U.S. infrastructure costs are so high, which is a perennial topic, but the Madrid case study provides unusually clear comparative data.
And now, for the part of the show I find genuinely useful, examining the claims we've been most confident about and asking what we might have wrong.
The claim I want to examine is one we've implicitly been making throughout this episode, that open-weight AI models like DeepSeek and local models like Qwen are fundamentally important as an alternative to proprietary API-based AI because they can't be taken away, can't be used for surveillance, and give users real ownership of the capability.
I've been advancing that argument pretty confidently. What's the countercase?
The strongest counterargument starts with hardware. Open-weight models are only accessible to whoever can afford the hardware to run them. GPT-4 class models require multiple high-end GPUs to run at useful speeds. Even Qwen at smaller scales requires hardware that costs several thousand dollars. If you look at who actually runs local models today, it's a small population of technically sophisticated users with disposable income or institutional affiliation. For the vast majority of AI users globally, open-weight is a theoretical freedom they can never exercise.
So the assumption we might be getting wrong is that distributing model weights is equivalent to distributing the capability.
Right. And there's a second assumption worth questioning, that hardware costs will follow the same downward curve as software. We've all absorbed the lesson that software reproduces at zero marginal cost, so open source software eventually becomes accessible to everyone. But AI inference hardware doesn't follow that curve in the same way. The computation required scales with model capability, and the most capable open models require hardware that's subject to export controls, specialized supply chains, and significant capital.
There's also an interesting question about training versus inference. Even if inference on existing open models becomes cheap, the organizations capable of training frontier-class models are narrowing, not widening, because training costs have increased faster than hardware has cheapened. So the open-weight model you run today was trained by a relatively small number of organizations with the capital and data to do it. The model's values, capabilities, and limitations are still shaped by those organizations, even if you're running the weights yourself.
If we're wrong about this, if the open AI as genuine democratization thesis doesn't hold, what's the signal to watch for? The most concrete one would be, if hardware costs for running capable models fail to decrease at the rate that PC hardware costs decreased from 1990 to 2005, if running a GPT-4 class model still requires a dedicated GPU cluster in 2028, the open weight thesis is in trouble, regardless of how many models get released.
The second signal is the training concentration metric. If in 2 years, the organizations capable of training competitive frontier models has contracted rather than expanded, if it's down from 10 to 5 rather than up from 10 to 50, that's evidence that openness at the inference layer doesn't translate to openness at the development layer in any practically meaningful way.
Those are tractable, falsifiable signals. We'll check back on them.